From KCRW in Santa Monica and PRI, Public Radio International, this is To the Point.
Another terror attack, the blame game, and immigration. Hello again, I'm Aaron Olney, and this is To the Point. Eight people, most from out of the country, were killed in yesterday's truck attack on a bike path near the World Trade Center. It was the first deadly strike of its kind in New York City since September 11th, but throngs of New Yorkers celebrated Halloween anyway. Police say the suspect from Uzbekistan was radicalized in this country as President Trump and Democrats worked the political angles in Washington. On the second half of our program, from Washington, D.C. to Washington State, where three local election campaigns aren't obscure anymore. Billionaire activists are pitting big money against Chevron, Phillips 66, and Koch Industries. The results could have real consequences for climate change. First, here's the news.
Check out KCRW's All News Channel, News 24. Programming from KCRW, NPR, BBC, and more. 24 hours a day. Go to kcrw.com/news24 or listen on KCRW's app.
Support for To the Point comes from the members of KCRW and from the Public Radio International Program Fund.
Hello again, Marvin Olney back with To the Point. The governor of Washington State wants to lead the fight against climate change, and that's focused attention on three local elections. The results could impact fracked oil from North Dakota, long-distance oil shipments by railroad, and a blue state's policy on climate change. Billionaire activists are spending big money on one side with major oil companies on the other. We'll hear more. First, the aftermath of yesterday's first deadliest strike of its kind in New York City since September 11, 2001. A 29-year-old green card holder from Uzbekistan mowed down pedestrians and cyclists on a bike path near the rebuilt World Trade Center. Eight people were killed. At least six were tourists from Argentina and Belgium. Here's the Deputy Police Commissioner John Miller describing evidence left behind by Saifullo Saipov.
He appears to have followed almost exactly to a T the instructions that ISIS has put out in its social media channels before, with instructions to their followers on how to carry out such an attack.
In the truck, Miller said, were notes left behind by the attacker.
The notes were handwritten in Arabic. They had symbols and words, but the gist of the note was that the Islamic State would endure forever.
Willie Rashbaum reports for the New York Times. Willie, it's good to have you. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Before we talk more about Saifullo Saipov, what about the victims?
There are about a dozen who are still in the hospital, in addition to the eight who died. Six of those were tourists from foreign countries, I believe five from Argentina and one from Germany, and two others who were Americans. During a briefing this morning, updating the condition, I believe that the fire commissioner indicated that there were several who had critical injuries, but they were stable and that they were expected to survive.
And quickly describe the place where they were walking and biking, and it's very close to the rebuilt World Trade Center.
Well, there is a sort of bike path and greenway that runs north from the bottom of Manhattan, essentially from Battery Park, up for several miles along the Hudson River. And there is a bike path that is, literally a stone's throw from the river for most of its length. That runs along that way. It is not much larger than a large truck. I ride up and down it with some frequency. It's very peaceful, even though there's a highway. The river is on one side of it, and the West Side Highway is on the other. But it's landscaped. There are trees, beautiful plantings when they bloom in the spring. It is an almost bucolic spot in the middle of an urban center.
Okay. The Department of Homeland Security has confirmed what President Trump said initially, that, in fact, the man who drove the truck and is the suspect in this came from Uzbekistan legally about 6 years ago. Is that right?
I believe he arrived in March of 2010.
Okay. And tell us more about him that you've been able to find out.
Well, we're in the earliest stages here, but he has lived in Ohio, in Florida, and most recently in New Jersey, where we understand he moved with his wife to be closer to his wife's family. He has three children. I think one of them was born recently. One of them is a newborn. He has worked as an Uber driver, as a truck driver, and was not someone who had shown a lot of signs, outward signs of radicalization, although few people that we've spoken to today have indicated that while he expressed some concerns about U.S. policies in Israel, he also, according to the people we interviewed, did not appear to be devout. He arrived for prayers late. There were other indications that he was not, that he didn't have all the characteristics of being someone who was extremely devout.
And probably most importantly, he has survived, has he not? Is it expected that he will survive well enough to be able to be questioned?
Well, we believe that he, at the briefing, they said that he had already been questioned.
Okay.
By investigators. It's likely that federal prosecutors in Manhattan are preparing charges against him. I gather the president has been tweeting about the possibility of sending him to Gitmo. As far as we know, the United States Attorney's Office here is proceeding as they would in any such terrorism case. They've prosecuted probably hundreds of these cases.
All right. Willie Rashbaum, again, a reporter for The New York Times, covering crimes of all sorts, this one in particular. Thanks so much for being with us.
Sure. Thank you.
In a moment, the incident goes political in Washington as well as New York. This is To the Point from PRI.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
KCRW thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com.
We're on Olney back with To the Point. President Trump, citing Fox News as his authority, blamed Democrats for yesterday's attack in New York. He tweeted that the killer entered the country under an immigration program supported by Chuck Schumer. He's the Senate Minority Leader, of course, and he represents New York State. Schumer replied by accusing the president of politicizing and dividing America at a time of tragedy. New York Governor Andrew Cuomo was asked about the president's failure to call him.
I am not bothered that the president didn't call. I am bothered by an attempt by anyone to try to politicize this situation. That plays right into the hands of the terrorist. They're trying to disrupt. They're trying to create mayhem. They're trying to divide. The president's tweets, I think, were not helpful. I don't think they were factual. I think they tended to point fingers and politicize the situation.
Philip Bump is national correspondent for The Washington Post. He is in New York, reporting once again on a national basis. Always good to have you on our program. Thanks for joining us.
Of course, my pleasure.
What more can you tell us about the attacker than we just heard from Willie Rashbaum? My understanding is that he might have had links to other people who have been investigated, although he himself has no record at all?
Honestly, I think that that was a pretty good overview in terms of what we know right now. There was a briefing earlier today from New York State and City authorities who went over some of what is known. Honestly, I can't speak to the point that you just made. As far as I know, Governor Cuomo said that he had been radicalized in the United States, that he sort of came to this fairly recently, well after he actually immigrated here. And beyond that, I think they're still trying to sort out some of the details.
Well, let's turn to the politics. That's your specialty. This is the second deadly attack that President Trump has had to deal with in weeks, the other one, of course, being the mass shooting in Las Vegas. But his return, his reaction has been very different.
That's exactly right. I mean, in the hours after the attack that occurred on October 1st in Las Vegas, Trump was very quick to say, you know, our hearts go out to you. We want to do whatever we can to be supportive of Las Vegas. But when pressed for actual policy proposals, such as banning bump stocks, a device that allowed the shooter in Vegas to shoot so rapidly, the White House was very quick to tamp that down and say, this is not the time. We should not politicize this. We should not have these conversations now while people are still mourning. By contrast, as you've heard and as I'm sure your listeners are aware, Donald Trump was very quick this morning, as he has been quick after other terror attacks, to make a policy case, to say that this particular visa program should be curtailed, should be ended, to blame Democrats for having implemented it in the first place, and this is within a matter of 12, 14 hours, to really make a case for tougher immigration restrictions based on what happened yesterday in New York.
The president, of course, famously has issued travel bans of different types from time to time. Would any of them have prevented this particular incident?
They would not have. So there have been three different versions of the travel ban covering different sets of countries. At no point in time was Uzbekistan, the country of origin of yesterday's attacker, included in any of those. In fact, if you look at the past 20 years, at no point in time would there have been a single death, terrorism-related death, that would have been prevented by any of the travel ban simply by virtue of where the people who committed these acts had come from. So he's focused now on this particular program, obviously giving him a point of leverage against Democrats. But it's important to know that this is a very small fraction of immigrants who arrive in the United States come through this particular program, something like 50,000 a year, while, you know, there are obviously hundreds of thousands of people that actually come into the country. So this is a very small slice that he's decided to focus on.
Philip Bump with The Washington Post. We'll come back to you in a moment. But first, here's President Trump talking about getting rid of the program that the suspect came into the country on.
Diversity lottery sounds nice. It's not nice. It's not good. It's not good. It hasn't been good. We've been against it. So we want to immediately work with Congress on the diversity lottery program, on terminating it, getting rid of it. We want a merit-based program.
Again, that's the President of the United States. Anastasia Tonello is with us, President-elect of the American Immigration Lawyers Association. Thank you for joining us.
My pleasure.
What is the diversity lottery visa program that the president is talking about and that the Department of Homeland Security has confirmed this man used to enter the country in 2010?
So the diversity visa program was established in 1990. It provides 50,000 visas annually to nationals from countries of low immigration to the United States. So the idea is to increase diversity in immigrants to ensure that there's not a certain part of the world that is overrepresented.
So the very purpose of the program then is to encourage immigration from countries that people don't usually come from.
That's exactly it. Yeah, so it's to increase ties and benefits to people who would normally not be able to or even think about coming to the U.S.
Is this something that could be then changed by Congress? I gather that Chuck Schumer had a lot to do with instituting it in the first place, and I've also heard that he may have been interested in repealing it.
Yeah, it is. It's absolutely within Congress, within their remit. They would have to pass the law to replace it, to repeal, replace it. There are a few bills in that are proposed right now that already have that in it. The bill in 2013 that actually passed the Senate repealed the diversity lottery. So it's definitely a program that's had a lot of attention. It's, you know, something, you know, giving benefits by lottery is not ideal, but, you know, it's unfortunately a part of our immigration system, and not just with the diversity lottery, other programs that are decided through a lottery as well.
Is there anything partisan about it? Once again, if Schumer was in favor of it, now he's in favor of repealing it. It sounds to me as if there's bipartisanship on that.
Yeah, I mean, it's probably one of those programs that's very easy to compromise on. So when there are many things on the table that people feel strongly about, the diversity lottery is one of those that probably has the least amount of support
okay.
in general.
All right, we'll see what happens in Congress. The president once again wants it repealed. Anastasia Tonello with the American Immigration Lawyers Association. Thanks a lot for helping us out.
Pleasure. Thanks.
Raffaello Pantucci is Director of International Security Studies at the Royal United Service Institute in London. Welcome to you.
Thank you.
We have not had a lot of truck attacks of this kind in this country. They have occurred, obviously, in Europe to a devastating effect. What can you tell us about them, and what sorts of measures can be taken to try to prevent them?
Well, I mean, the methodology that we've seen in terms of using sort of a large vehicle, a truck or sort of, you know, large SUV or something larger than that, and driving it into a crowd is something that we've seen increasingly used. Now, it's interesting because it's something that actually terrorist groups and Al-Qaeda, in fact, used to call for people to do for some time. But it's only recently that we've seen it sort of really take off as something that we can see groups are advancing as an idea sort of repeatedly, and also as something that's really cool on in the imagination of individuals who decide to launch these sorts of attacks. So recently we've seen, you know, with the incidents that we saw, for example, in Nice in France, the one that we saw in Berlin at the Christmas market, and the sort of success of those really showed people that this methodology could deliver a very loud impact and bring a lot of attention to an incident. So, you know, people tend to emulate these, and they tend to now has sort of taken off as the approach that groups or that individuals like to take. In terms of what we can do about sort of preventing these things, I mean, it is very difficult because, you know, it's very difficult to understand where it is security forces can sort of intervene. On the one hand, if you're talking about access to vehicles, well, you know, we all have access to vehicles, and, you know, it's very easy to get access to one if you do not have one in very legitimate ways. And there's lots of legitimate reasons why you can have access to a car or a truck or something else. So it's very difficult for security services to be able to sort of monitor, you know, usage of these things because we all kind of do it. On the other side of the equation, if you're going to try to separate out, you know, crowds from vehicles, well, you know, the difficulty becomes, where do you stop doing that? You know, okay, it can make sense in certain sort of large public spaces, you know, a sort of main part of a city, you know, in a sort of city square or something, or a sort of pedestrianized area which is known for shopping. You know, maybe it makes sense to put up bollards there that will sort of stop, you know, trucks being able to get into crowds. But, you know, that has consequences potentially for the businesses that are there that have to get their sort of products to it, that want it actually to stay open because they need to get their products into their shops. But then the other question becomes, well, where do you stop doing it? If, you know, I've understood where this particular incident took place in New York, it wasn't a particularly prominent location. It was sort of a street in New York. And the question becomes there, where, what streets do you stop putting up bollards that separate the public from vehicles and, you know, create a sort of impediment in the sort of street?
Let me get back to Philip Bump again with The Washington Post. Again, you're in New York. This not only involves immigration policy, but also the word diversity is in the program. That is something that the president has, to some extent, railed against for a long, long time. Is this red meat for the right? Do you think it's a way of distracting attention away from what they've been concerned about, which is, of course, of late, the Mueller investigation into possible ties to Russia?
Well, I think that even without the Mueller investigation, Donald Trump would use this, would seize upon this to move forward on his political agenda. I think you're right that there are components of this which very much do play to Donald Trump's base. Certainly his base is as skeptical of immigrants as is he. So any system by which immigration might be cracked down upon is something that I think his base generally approves of. That this is also a diversity program. I mean, Trump himself, as you heard, said, made a comment about the word diversity itself. Diversity and political correctness are sort of seen as these two things that are things that Trump and Republicans' opponents care for more than they do. So yes, there's a lot to this. I mean, again, it is a small part of immigration itself, but there are lots of ways in which this plays politically well for Donald Trump with the people that support him.
Would you expect Congress to repeal the bill that we've been hearing about, the diversity lottery, quickly, and would President Trump then claim a victory?
It's quite possible. I mean, obviously, Republicans control both sides of Congress. It's not clear whether or not Democrats will be able to put up a fight, if they want to put up a fight in its defense, as you heard. And as you know, Jeff Flake, for example, Senator from Arizona, mentioned this morning on Twitter, this is something that Schumer had already indicated that he was willing to give up. If there were some sort of deal worked out, it certainly seems feasible that there could be that this could be rolled back.
Mr. Pantucci, back to you in London, and let's focus once again on the suspect involved. Uzbekistan is a place where very few people come to America, want to come to America, apparently. What more do we know about it? How likely is it that others who've come from there might be radicalized in the way that this gentleman allegedly was?
I mean, I think that, you know, there's been a kind of trend globally of people from Central Asia more broadly, not just Uzbekistan, but also its neighboring countries, of showing up in terrorist investigations around the world. And this is a sort of something that we've noticed for some time. And you can see it in a number of other attacks around the world, in St. Petersburg, in Istanbul, and in Stockholm, where there have been people who are Central Asian who've been involved in the attacks. At the same time, I think, you know, we have to be careful to not sort of stigmatize an entire population as a result of, you know, this sort of trend.
Of
we are seeing a general trend of radicalization taking grip amongst a lot of different communities all over the world. And in some ways, the thing that's most striking when we look at the phenomenon of, you know, radicalization and people joining and or, you know, aspiring to join or do launching attacks in advance of ISIS, ISIS name, the sort of incredible diversity of individuals that we see involved in that. You know, and I think that really reflects the fact that you've got an ideology that's managed to sort of really spread itself and, you know, ingrain itself amongst the sort of broader Muslim population more generally. But I think at the same time, we have to remember that these are isolated individuals. Now, I don't know the exact numbers of people who've migrated to the United States from Uzbekistan, but I would imagine it's in the many thousands. You know, of them, we've now got one individual who has decided to go down this path, and we still don't really know exactly why he's gone down and whether there is a particular reason, is there a link to his Uzbek heritage in that. So, you know, I think we have to be careful on the one hand to not stigmatize, but then on the other hand, observe that there is something happening in terms of radicalization more broadly and some questions around what's happening in Central Asia in particular.
Thank you about your making the point about stigmatization, categorization, stereotyping. We so tend to do that. And very quickly, we'll just have 10 seconds left. What about a man who has three children and a wife?
I mean, that's, you know, it's actually very common for people to be married and to be individuals who appear to be quite well assimilated. Often there's a specific trigger that happens in their lives, but outwardly they can appear up to that moment a fairly well integrated individual. I think we still have to see the full stories of this, the full details of this case, but it's not totally abnormal.
Rafael Pantucci, at the Director of International Studies, Security Studies in London. Thank you so much for being with us. Thanks to Philip Bubb with the Washington Post. In a moment, from Washington, D.C. to Washington State, where three local elections have activists and oil companies trying to outspend each other, we'll find out why these political races are so important, so valuable in the fight over climate change. This is To the Point from PRI.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing.
Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW Donation Car. Already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Norman Olney back with To The Point. Off here, local elections in the Pacific Northwest are normally quiet affairs, but today's big issues put campaigns that otherwise might seem small on the political map. First up, there is a state Senate seat up for grabs in the suburbs of Seattle, in the very blue state of Washington. Ben Storo is national reporter at E&E, which covers energy and the environment. And Ben Storo, good to have you with us.
Thanks for having me.
Tell us a bit about this election for the state Senate seat in the Seattle suburbs. Why is it so important?
Well, what we've seen since President Trump has been elected is the fight over climate change has sort of migrated from Washington, D.C., out into the states. And Washington State, as it happens, is sort of, you could say it's on the front lines of that, because the governor of Washington, Jay Inslee, is one of the most ambitious climate governors, if we can call him that, in the country. His big holdup has been that Senate Republicans hold a one-seat majority, and they have hampered a lot of what he wanted to do. And so this race has the potential to switch control of the Senate, which would give Democrats control of all three elected branches in Olympia, and could potentially unleash Jay Inslee to pursue some of his climate ambitions.
What would that mean if he pursued his climate ambitions?
Well, there's a number of things that have been talked about. People have talked about boosting Washington State's renewable portfolio standard, for instance. That's how much utilities are required to get from sources like wind and solar. But maybe the biggest ticket item that could come up is a carbon tax. A lot of economists believe that a carbon tax is perhaps the most effective way to combat climate change. But the idea has proven pretty politically unpopular because it's a tax, of course. And Washington State has more than any other state sort of kicked this idea around. Inslee proposed that as part of a budget fix this year. Another lawmaker proposed it. And last year, in 2016, they even had a carbon tax on the ballot. Voters voted it down. But there's some thought that maybe that could come back.
Now, you're saying that considering who wins in the Senate race we've talked about, if, in fact, it's a Democrat, then the governor will have in control of all three branches of government. You have called this the state Senate race that we're talking about one of the most consequential races on climate policy right now, and perhaps the most. Why do you say that? It wouldn't extend beyond the state of Washington, would it?
Sure, you're absolutely right, and I think that's an important point to make. I mean, state policy only goes so far. It's just sort of the nature of where climate fights are at the moment, in the sense that you know, the federal government really is not doing anything on the climate front at the moment, so it's effectively up to the states. I should say Washington isn't the only important climate election this fall. New Jersey has a gubernatorial election. They are talking about both candidates, the Republican and the Democrat, have promised to return to the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative, which is a cap-and-trade program amongst nine northeastern states. Chris Christie pulled New Jersey out of that. So that's pretty important. And then in Virginia, the gubernatorial race there, the current governor, Terry McAuliffe, has signed an executive order which would essentially pave the way for Virginia to also join the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative. But whether that happens or not depends on whether the Democrat or the Republican there wins.
Back to the far west, you said Jay Inslee, the governor of Washington, is in the forefront when it comes to climate change. Well, what about Governor Brown in California? And might there be a relationship established between the two states if, in fact, Inslee is able to take over the Senate?
Yeah, I mean, that is another one of the things that is possible. California has its cap and trade program. It has some pretty rigorous requirements in the way the eastern, northeastern states have talked about joined up, and to form a cap and trade program. There's been similar talk about doing something like that out west, and it's possible that a Democratic win would pave the way for Inslee to really engage Jerry Brown in a way that hasn't been possible before.
Ben Sturro, once again, with E&E covering energy and the environment. Now, from the suburbs of Seattle, we want to go south to Vancouver. That's on the Columbia River, Washington's border with Oregon. Molly Solomon is based there for Oregon Public Broadcasting. Good to have you on our program.
Thanks, Warren. Thanks for having me.
You've got a pretty interesting race going on in Vancouver, one that normally wouldn't attract any attention at all. Tell us about it.
That's right. That's the seat for the Port of Vancouver Board of Commissioners. Normally, these are very sleepy races. Candidates are usually incumbents just trying to, you know, get their six-term seat back. And people usually raise about $5,000 for an election for these kind of races. What we're seeing this year is very unusual. We have looked at the filings for the campaign contributions. Now we're looking at $1 million race for one of these seats on the port here. And I think that shows how important this one seat is for a lot of outside interests looking at Vancouver, Washington.
Tell us more. Why is it so important? What would be allowed if, in fact, one candidate won as opposed to another one?
Well, really, at the center of all of this is a proposed oil terminal at the Port of Vancouver. This is a multi-million-dollar project. It's been talked about for a couple years now. And, you know, basically, the person that sits on this seat could shift the power against the terminal. There's already an anti-terminal person on the board. If another anti-terminal commissioner gets voted in, that could significantly put the project at risk. This is a very big project that, you know, it's called Vancouver Energy, and it's a $210 million terminal that, if built, would be the largest in the nation. It would handle 360,000 barrels of crude oil a day and would bring those from the Bakken region in the Midwest, and it would bring that oil along the Columbia River Gorge and would be based in Washington, at Vancouver, and it would then go out to refineries on the West Coast, possibly to Asia. So I think Vancouver's location in the Northwest makes this a desirable place. There's also the appeal of jobs, but for a lot of folks, they also are worried about the environment. They're worried about the risk to people that live there, dangers that could happen if there's an accident on the rail line, and just putting that much oil and additional trains going through those towns have a lot of people looking at this election a lot of money going into this election.
How long are these trains? How many of them are there per day?
Well, on average, every day, about 4 mile-and-a-half long crude oil trains would come through that terminal. They'd be coming from the Midwest, and they'd be going into Vancouver along that river line.
Coming down the Columbia River Gorge.
Exactly. And for people that maybe know, you know, that the gorge is very important, and I think it's important to the identity of these towns that live along the gorge. Just last summer, there was a train derailment in Mosier, Oregon, that's close to Hood River. So I think a lot of people have that in their mind still. Luckily, there were no fatalities, but it was a big deal. You know, that was a big fiery train crash. And so I think there's concern among people who live here that we don't want that to happen in our community, and we don't want that risk to increase as we bring more trains into our town.
All right, Molly Solomon again with Oregon Public Broadcasting, and the money there involves $5,000 normally, and now $1 million for just one candidate running for the Port Authority race. But up in the suburbs of Washington, we're talking serious money. Ben Sturro, once again, back to you with E&E. How much money is being spent, and who's spending it on that one?
Yeah, the projections up there, folks expect $10 million to be spent by both candidates by the time voters go to the polls. And we've got all the big names nationally from both the climate side and the energy side. Michael Bloomberg has given $250,000 to political action committees supporting the Democrat. Tom Steyer has given $125,000. On the other side, you're seeing a lot of oil interests line up for the Republican, Phillips 66, Chevron, even the Koch brothers. Their spending is well in excess of $500,000 together. So, as you said, it's serious money.
Serious money, and obviously a lot at stake there. Let me introduce Eric DePlace, Energy Policy Director with Sightline Institute. That's a think tank that focuses on sustainability issues in the Northwest. Thank you very much for joining us.
Well, thanks for having me.
We heard from Ben Storrow that the race up there could be one of the most important in the nation, and it would appear that the race for the terminal board in Vancouver is pretty important as well. What's your take on these, and how would they impact sustainability?
Well, I think there's one additional piece of context that goes a little bit beyond control of the state legislature, and that is what's been happening in the Pacific Northwest over the last, call it, 7 or 8 years. And I think, you know, most folks don't pay too much attention to the upper left-hand corner of the country, but there has been this real fundamental transformation in the way that this region has operated. So what I'm referring to is, you know, over the last, again, 8 years or so, we have seen proposals for something like 7 coal export terminals, maybe a dozen oil-by-rail terminals, a whole spaghetti bowl of natural gas pipelines. And all of this stuff being backed by the fossil fuel industry, mostly not in the big wealthy progressive centers of the state, but, you know, in kind of, you know, working smaller cities. And there's been this huge debate all across Washington, across Oregon, about whether or not we should site these projects. And what's happened, somewhat to everyone's surprise, is that we looked back 8 years later and local communities have fought off every single one of the projects. I think that it's fair to say at this point there's this tremendous frustration from the coal industry, from the oil industry, gas industry, that they're not able to get their projects cited. And so now we're seeing them turn to what I think is probably their most dangerous weapon, which is, you know, just basically huge suitcases full of cash that they can dump into local races.
So there's also, as I understand it, a referendum going on in Spokane out in the northeast part of the state of Washington. What's that about?
Yeah, that's an interesting one. So for folks who may not know, Spokane is a sort of leans blue. It's a city of about 215,000 people. It's in a very conservative part of the state. But what's interesting about Spokane is that all of the rail traffic that would serve the coal export terminals, these mile-and-a-half-long coal trains, all of the rail traffic that would serve these oil-by-rail terminals like Vancouver Energy, which Molly mentioned, all of them pass through Spokane. And so there's been this increasing anxiety in that community about the risks and frankly, just the traffic delay of pulling, you know, dozens, if not scores, of coal and oil trains through that community. So some folks got together and they, you know, put on the ballot this initiative that would basically levy a small fee on coal and oil trains that pass through town. Now, there are a lot of folks who doubt whether that is sort of a legal ballot initiative, whether it would actually survive a court challenge. Nonetheless, it's on the ballot in this one city, you know, sort of a mid-sized city. And surprisingly, it has garnered a huge amount of opposition from the rail industry and from the fossil fuel industry that seems way out of proportion to the actual sort of force of the ballot initiative.
Why do you say that? I would think that anything that makes it more difficult for them to build what they want to build on the coasts and to have rail lines available for the oil to be shipped to the west would be something they'd want to defeat.
Well, fair enough. That's absolutely right. But, you know, keep in mind that, you know, it is not normally the case that a city or a state or a local government can levy a fee on trains that pass through it. Those powers are normally reserved for the federal government.
Okay.
That being said, I think it is fair to say this becomes another referendum on the popularity of coal and oil, even in the conservative part of the Pacific Northwest. Probably, you know, if we did public opinion polling in places like Spokane, there would be a clear sense that these industries are very unpopular. The locals don't want them. There's nothing but economic downside all through these rural and mostly conservative areas. And so I think what they fear is finding out that the public really does not want this stuff cited in the Northwest, which would be damaging to their long-term objectives. Again, they have, you know, literally dozens of these export projects on the table, and they can't get any of them built.
Okay. People may not like the coal and oil industries, but they do, of course, require energy. Tom Tseng is professor of energy business at the University of Tulsa. Good to have you on our program.
Hi, Warren. Nice to talk to you again.
Well, thank you.
Yeah, I mean, there's no two ways about it. I mean, if you know, regions of the country don't want that type of infrastructure, that's certainly understandable. And of course, you know, as your other callers have pointed out, the oil and gas industry, they've got a huge financial stake, and they're going to, you know, pursue these things. And if they're turned away, they're turned away. Part of the issue really is, it's truly the economics in terms of the economics of the world, global oil markets. I mean, as we sit here today talking, you know, the U.S. domestic WTI crude oil is trading $54 a barrel. Brent North Sea crude oil is trading $60 a barrel. This is a train that you can't get in front of at the moment, meaning the oil and gas industry is going to continue to produce at these levels. If anything, you're going to now see accelerated drilling, and they're going to be looking for outlets. And again, unfortunately, for what's going on in the Northwest, the most lucrative markets for crude oil nationally, and also natural gas in the form of liquefied natural gas, happens to be the Pacific Rim. So yes, the companies are naturally going to try to get as close, you know, from a logistics and cost standpoint, as close to Asia as they can. We're currently, you know, we're exporting right now a record amount of oil, about 3 million barrels a day by tanker, predominantly out of the Gulf Coast, and around through the Panama Canal, which is, you know, as you know, the expansion has been opened finally. So you have what they call the VLCCs, the very large crude carriers. So sure, from a business perspective, you know, oil companies would rather have a much more direct route to be able to offload tankers in the Northwest. But again, you know, if the residents of that area don't want that, and I fully understand that sentiment, it's not going to happen. But the fact is, the oil is going to get there eventually. I think one of the things I will say I appreciate about your callers is they're not saying, you know, death to the oil industry. They're just saying, hey, listen, not where we are. We see these potential impacts, and we're not crazy about it. And I have to agree, you know, I mean, crude by rail is certainly a lot more dangerous than crude by pipeline. And so there are legitimate issues there. But given the economics, given the pricing, given the incentive that the companies have, I mean, they're going to continue. These projects are going to continue to be proposed. Again, as your callers have pointed out, it appears as though the oil and gas industry is now saying, okay, if we can't get these, you know, permitted through a normal process, then we're going to try to influence, elections in that area. But just a couple of quick comments. I mean, for instance, in terms of the carbon tax situation, obviously, you know, Washington State, that was...
Wait a minute, before you go into the carbon tax, let me just go back to Eric DePlace very quickly with the Sideline Institute. If, in fact, people don't get the terminal, or the oil industry doesn't get the terminal, and if there's impediments to bringing the oil in by rail, what about a pipeline? Would that be acceptable, do you think, to those voters who might object to the other strategies?
I suspect not. I mean, we've got a viable proposal for an oil pipeline in southern British Columbia right now, and very much as is the case in Oregon and Washington, local communities are just absolutely up in arms about it. They don't want that built either. And I think what's happening in the Northwest is similar to what's happening actually in a lot of other places too. People see development from the fossil fuel industry. They look at the costs and benefits, the trade-offs, and they simply don't want it in their neighborhood or in their community. And I think there's good reason for it. My sense is that not only are there direct sort of health and safety risks associated with those projects, people get climate change as well, but they also see the corrupting influence that the industry has on democracy and on local democracy. And so I think there is this real growing concern and anxiety that if you invite these guys to town, what you lose ultimately isn't just a pipeline route or a rail terminal. What you lose ultimately is control of your civic government.
Okay, let's take a look at what possible alternatives there might be. We're going to do that after we take a very brief break. This is To the Point from PRI.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Well, and only back with To the Point, talking today about Washington State in particular and its issues with oil and a governor who wants very much to be involved in the fight against climate change and three local elections that might have an impact on his ability to do that in the case of the state Senate seat in the suburbs of Seattle and in the case of the terminal argument in south of Seattle in Vancouver, the question of oil by rail comes up. Molly Solomon with Oregon Public Broadcasting, let me ask you, do you agree with Eric DePlace that even if the or if the terminal were not accepted, that people would accept a pipeline rather than oil shipped by rail?
I mean, I think the big thing that I've heard when I've gone to, you know, these different candidate forums and a lot of the public meetings held on the terminal is that people just don't want to be associated with an oil town. I think a lot of that reflects how people feel like their city wants to be known. You know, in some ways, Vancouver is seen as a suburb of Portland, Oregon, which is right across the river. But I think Vancouver doesn't want their identity to be the home of whether it's a pipeline that's going to feed oil to Asia or refineries on the West Coast, or it's the largest rail terminal in the country. It's just a sense that people do not want to be, you know, basically run by a fossil fuel corporation. And I think they're seeing that in their local election. People are very angry because of the disproportional funding that's going to a candidate that has come out in support of the terminal. I mean, nearly 90% of his funding is coming from one person and one person alone, and that's the oil company that wants to build a terminal there. So I think people see the corporation as coming in and maybe dictating how democracy is run in their town, and that's really made people angry. And that's actually had the effect of people are supporting the other candidate because they see that as more a broad base of support coming out for the person that's running on a platform against the terminal.
So, Tom, saying back to you, you're a professor of the energy business at the University of Tulsa. You said earlier that if the projects we've talked about aren't passed, somehow the oil will find its way to the West Coast. What about Canada? Is that a likely alternative?
Yeah, actually it is. I mean, Ben had mentioned, there is a project, and I have to say this. I local municipalities, for a large part, can tend to thwart the route of a pipeline. But generally, when you're talking about a long, a long haul, a great distance pipeline, it's going to be a federal authority that's going to have the actual authority as to whether it gets built or not. I mean, we saw that with Dakota Access, unfortunately. That, you know, the federal government and, of course, in Canada, the provincial government and the actual federal government of Canada will have the right to determine whether or not a pipeline gets built. But I guess one of the things that I think that there's a broader picture here, and I think a lot of people fail to see that, and that is if you look at government data, about right now, slightly more than 10% of all the energy produced in the United States is coming from every single source of alternative and renewable fuels. So we're talking hydro, solar, wind, biomass, wood, you name it. It's slightly more than 10%. That's actually the reality within which we live. We're going to be dealing with fossil fuels on some level for decades. While that particular piece of our energy portfolio expands, and it will expand, we continue to see increased wind generation, solar, those things. We're going to be relying on fossil fuels for decades, not to mention the least of which is going to be plastics. People tend to forget that plastics, which we use in every aspect of our lives these days, come from oil and natural gas. And so, again, as I mentioned earlier, if there are, you know, areas like in the Northwest and they're like, you know, we don't want crude by rail coming through here, we don't want a pipeline, you know, that's fine. But you have an industry that is going to find another way to get these products you know, to the markets where they get the, you know, basically derive the best value.
I think our listeners should know and our other guests should know that although you were in the gas and oil industry for 20 years, you are, in fact, a believer in climate change and somebody who wants to see it dealt with. So what about then the fact that a lot of the oil we've been talking about with these projects, as I understand it, is destined for export? Why should people let this stuff come through their towns or through their cities or down the Columbia River Gorge if it's going to be exported to Asia?
Well, and really, Warren, I can't argue with that. In other words, if people say, well, wait a minute, if it's being exported, then it isn't, you know, you can't, it's hard to justify that it's a, you know, that's, for instance, it's a U.S. demand need. But when you look at the overall balance of oil supply, this market is looking for outlets. You know, again, part of the argument for the terminal is that some of that crude oil would get to refineries in the West Coast. Vancouver Energy mentioned Nevada and Arizona, and that's just not going to happen. You're not going to get crude oil from the Bakken over to Vancouver and then by tanker down to, offload it in California and then run it back towards Nevada and Arizona. That's just not going to happen because you've got a ton of oil being produced in West Texas that will more than take care of the needs there. But you're right. I mean, it's hard to justify something like that if you know for a fact that every barrel is going to be exported. We know that some of this at least is proposed to go to refineries in California, which would reduce the amount that they're actually having to import.
But there is money to be made. I mean, I think that's the bottom line. What about the carbon tax?
You know, the interesting thing about the carbon tax is, and again, obviously, the referendum in Washington State failed a year ago, in part because, I mean, environmentalists were also opposed to it because it was, the issue seemed to be, anyhow, the distribution of the money. I mean, if you don't return it in some form or fashion to the citizens, you're raising the cost of every single thing involved in fossil fuels. I mean, if it's a power plant, then they're going to go to the Public Utility Commission, and they're going to get an increase in the rate because of the increased cost because of a carbon tax. If you've got people being charged a carbon tax per gallon of gasoline, they're going to find some way, if they can, to go to another state and buy that gasoline. I mean,
the point is clear, and we're almost out of time. Ben Storrow, very quickly, with E&E, covering energy and environment. What about that? You said that the carbon tax would be the best way to deal with climate change, and yet will people be willing to pay that kind of cost?
Yeah, I mean, that is those are the issues, and it's a big part of the reason that a carbon tax hasn't been taken up. I think the thinking, as I understand it, behind a carbon tax is that, as opposed, say, to the Clean Power Plan, which you've got a lot of regulation, it's one sector of the economy, complicated, it might not really get at the problem. A carbon tax is broad-based, it touches every sector of the economy, and it will drive consumption of fossil fuels down.
Very quickly, how likely is the Democrat to win in the suburb of Seattle and to give the governor of Washington a chance to really get active in the area of climate change? Is it close, or what's happening?
My understanding is the last poll that I saw, that the Democrat had the lead in the polls. But if the last year has taught us anything, it's that we maybe shouldn't be making predictions.
Don't bet on these things. Molly Solomon, quickly, with Oregon Public Broadcasting. The terminal likely to go down or not?
Well, we'll see. It depends on who's elected next week at
election. Do you have any polls?
Well, there haven't been that many polls that have gone out, at least publicly. The candidates themselves have been internally polling. But I think I would also say it's safe to say not to make a prediction on this one.
All right. Politics, always uncertain. Thanks to Molly Solomon. Thanks to Ben Storrow. Thanks to Eric DePlace with the Sightline Institute and Tom Tseng at the University of Tulsa as well. I'm Warren Olney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live and podcast, as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.